ability to videotape voters at the polls. B. Moorhead with Texas Impacts says many think the proposed laws are diversions from larger problems facing Texas, but she believes voting suppression is much more about the numbers of young people of color in Texas soon to be of voting age.
Voter suppression in the current environment is not about distracting people from things that already happened. It's about a thumb on the scale of what could happen in the future.
Republican lawmakers in Texas, much like their counterparts in Georgia, say the new voting bills are necessary to improve trust and confidence in the outcome of elections. At a recent House committee meeting, Texas Impact Advocacy Director Joshua Houston told lawmakers that HB 6 is so unclear, it appears members of his group would be breaking the law by assisting voters who seek help.
Under the language, we would be felons for distributing mail-in ballot applications during a local ballot initiative or constitutional amendment election if we have taken a position for or against that measure.
Moorhead says voters have shown no intention of fraud and shouldn't have to jump through hoops to exercise their constitutional right.
Faith communities look with deep suspicion on legislative proposals that exclude people from the process because we know exclusion in all of our scriptural traditions ends badly for the excluders.
Governor Greg Abbott has said he believes there was fraud in the 2020 presidential election, but not in Texas. On Monday, the Senate unanimously passed two election security bills, one requiring that a paper record be created of every ballot that is cast, and another creating a ballot auditing system. For Public News Service, I'm Roz Brown.
President Joe Biden calls for peaceful protests after police in Minnesota fatally shoot Dante Wright. Mitch McConnell slams Biden's infrastructure plan as a Trojan horse, and states are rated for their early voting options. With more on the story, it's Mary Sherman with 2021 Talks.
Welcome to 2021 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
The anger, pain, and trauma that exists in the black community in that environment is real. It's serious and it's consequential. But it will not justify violence and or looting.
President Joe Biden called for an investigation into the police shooting of Dante Wright in a Minneapolis suburb, which sparked protests and riots. Wright was killed when an officer accidentally discharged her handgun instead of a stun gun during a traffic stop. The incident came as former Minneapolis police officer Derek Chauvin's trial and the death of George Floyd enters its third week. Also Monday, the president pitched his $2.7 trillion infrastructure plan to a bicameral group of lawmakers.
I'm prepared to negotiate as to the extent of my infrastructure project as well as how we pay for it.
Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell argued the plan uses infrastructure as a Trojan horse for tax hikes and other policies.
They're embarking on an Orwellian campaign to convince everybody that any government policy whatsoever can be labeled infrastructure.
Fallout continues over Georgia's new election law, which critics say restricts voter access. Actor Will Smith is pulling production of a big-budget project out of the state in protest. Defenders of the law say the outrage is based on misinformation and argue it will uphold election integrity. New data from the Center for Election Innovation and Research shows two-thirds of states offer ample early voting opportunities. As some states consider rolling back voting options, Executive Director David Becker hopes their review can help set the record straight.
There were claims after the baseball All-Star game was moved from Georgia to Colorado that Colorado was harder to vote in than Georgia. That was just false. And so we wanted to give some context to this.
Eight states ranked in the middle for early voting access and seven as most restrictive for not offering any mail or early voting options.
Regardless of the politics, we can be improving things. This is not only a Republican problem. This is a problem in some blue states as well, such as New York.
Former Obama-era ambassador to Malta, Gina Abercrombie Winstanley, was named Monday as the State Department's newly created Chief Diversity and Inclusion Officer.
We will ensure that the Department of State becomes the organization that deserves the devotion, the sacrifice, and the dedication that so many of us have freely given.
The White House also tapped former New Jersey Attorney General Ann Milgram to head the Drug Enforcement Administration, Tucson Police Chief Chris Magnus to lead Customs and Border Protection, and Christine Wormuth as Secretary of the Army. If approved, she would be the first woman in the position. Former U.N. Ambassador Nikki Haley says she won't mount a bid for the White House in 2024 should former President Trump decide to run again. Trump is reportedly considering a comeback, which has delayed other potential candidates from coming forward. Cole Hemstreet contributed reporting for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. I'm Mary Sherman. Thanks for listening.
a Native community-based school, is in the works in Rapid City, South Dakota. Fort Lewis College will host a dialogue on boarding schools, and FEMA offers assistance for COVID-19 funeral expenses. With those stories and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Indigenous news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. A new community-based school in Rapid City, South Dakota, will immerse students in Lakota language and culture. The effort is a response to the refusal by state and local leaders to open similar schools around the state. Lee Strubinger reports.
The NDN Collective is behind the new school. The nonprofit organization focuses on Indigenous advocacy and has tried to push the state to approve schools that teach Ocheti Chacoan essential understandings. That curriculum is centered around Lakota language and culture. State lawmakers rejected the proposals twice, so now organizers are taking the idea into their own hands. Sarah Pierce is the Director of Education Equity at NDN Collective. She says the new Rapid City School will be designed by Indigenous people for Indigenous people. It will teach subjects in Lakota.
No one knows needs better than authentic community representation. And so with that, that will set the school apart. I think with the cultural norms such as kinship and such, and the priority of Lakota language and culture as a deep embedded foundational aspect of school, not an elective, will set us apart.
The graduation rate among Indigenous students in South Dakota is the lowest of any group. Pierce says the school will aim to close that achievement gap.
When we think about the compulsory imposition of education on Indigenous peoples in America, this school will really challenge what history has taught us, that we cannot impose something on a demographic.
More than 20% of Rapid City school students are Native American. The Indian Collective, based in Rapid City, will open and fund the school. It's expected to open in the fall of 2022 with 40 kindergarten students the first year. For National Native News, I'm Lee Strubinger in Rapid City.
The Biden administration has canceled the sale of a National Archives building in Seattle, citing a lack of tribal consultation. Alaska Native and Pacific Northwest tribes opposed the sale when it was revealed during the Trump administration. They said it would displace documents and artifacts important to their heritage. The plan was to rehome them in other archives facilities in Missouri and California. The acting director of the Office of Management and Budget wrote a letter last week saying she's withdrawing approval for the sale of the archives facility. She said the process that led to the decision to sell the building did not comply with the Biden administration's commitment to consult with tribes. The Alaska collection has already been displaced once. In 2014, the National Archives closed its Anchorage branch and moved almost everything to Seattle. Fort Lewis College in Colorado is hosting a virtual day of dialogue next week on Native American boarding schools. Students, educators, and alumni will discuss boarding schools and tuition waivers, including at Fort Lewis. The college established a committee in 2019 to examine its origin as a boarding school for Native Americans. Students and educators from the University of Minnesota Morris, which shares a similar history, will take part in the event. It's being hosted through an initiative to bring Indigenous scholars to campus. All sessions are open to the public. The Federal Emergency Management Agency is offering financial funeral assistance to families for COVID-19 related expenses. Applications are now being accepted through a telephone assistance line. There are no online applications at this time. FEMA is experiencing a high volume of calls and is encouraging people to continue to try to connect. The funeral assistance line began taking applications Monday and will operate Monday through Friday from 9 to 9 Eastern. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
You're listening to a spring membership drive edition of the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, April 13th, 2021. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Al Kahn, the producer is Yasmin Kobanoglu, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Roz Brown, Georgia Fort, Antonia Gonzalez, Mike Moen, and Mary Sherman. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Yasmin Kobanoglu. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO at 8, it's Wednesday Talk Radio, news and commentary on local, national, and international issues. At 9, Inside Washington County with Rob Solomon brings residents the information they need to fully engage with issues in their community. At 9:30, it's Culture in Motion with Mike Crenshaw, featuring art, culture, and politics with hip-hop as the guiding light. Then at 10, it's the Children's Hour, educational and entertaining programming for listeners of all ages. All of these KBOO programs, including the evening news, are made possible by support from our members. KBOO's currently in our spring membership drive. If you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321.
KBOO News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
We feel kind of like there are these whales or something circling us, and the people who live here, the people who work at the mill, we're just sort of at the mercy of these. I mean, we're talking lots of money here, you know, lots and lots of money.
SDS Lumber Company is part of a dying breed. It's been family-owned for 75 years. The company has good rapport with both its workers and local environmental groups. SDS is also one of the largest employers and landowners in Klickitat County, Washington. They don't just cut wood. They lease offices, provide homes, and lend their resources to environmentalist causes. After 75 years of family ownership, SDS Lumber Company is going to the auction block. Some residents in Klickitat County worry that their era of conscientious forestry is coming to an end. I'm speaking with Pat Arnold, a volunteer with the environmental advocacy group Friends of the White Salmon River.
SDS has been locally owned for a long time, about 75 years, and now it's going up for sale. Why is that concerning for you?
It's concerning because they own 100,000 acres in four counties, and they have a mill. They're one of the few remaining integrated, vertically integrated lumber companies, timber companies. In other words, they own the land, as it says in our video. They own the land, they own the mill. This has caused them to have a longer-term rotation for their timber harvest. They have old trees in the 60 to 70 year, 80 year range in some places. Their average rotation is about 60 years as opposed to 35 at the state average. And so this is all very healthy and good for the environment and for the community, the people who work there. They have 350 employees. And the prospect of this all just disappearing into the hands of, say, a real estate investment trust like Weyerhaeuser is really alarming. That would lead to much shorter rotation. I mean, they couldn't cut everything in 2 years, but they could certainly cut everything way faster than SDS is going to cut. So the prospect of the mill disappearing and those 350 people being put out of work, the timber harvest speeding up, and real estate investment trust coming in wanting to just cut and turn over, it's just alarming.
So far, SDS Lumber Company has been a fairly stable part of the community.
Absolutely. They've been a cornerstone of this community on the west end of Klickitat County since they started in 75 years ago. They employ drivers, they employ people who work in the woods, the mill. They work with a lot of contract lumber operators, guys who have their own businesses and take, you know, will do a timber harvest on contract for SDS. They have a deal with a mill in Stevenson, which is the next county over, it's Camania County, to supply timber to them. I'm not sure about the details of that, but they're like foundational to the economy.
Is that common among lumber companies, or does that make SDS kind of unique?
Well, it used to be, I think, more common, but as I say, there's very few companies left like SDS that, I mean, most, a lot of timber has moved into, timber land has moved into the hands of real estate investment trusts as opposed to timber companies. And I mean, it's been devastating to many small rural communities to have this kind of transformation happen.
You mentioned a quick clear cut that might take about 2 years to accomplish, whereas companies like SDS used to do longer term rotations. In the long term, after those cuts that might happen if an out-of-state company or a larger corporation buys out SDS, what are things going to look like for Klickitat County?
Well, first of all, let me clarify. Not a two-year rotation. There are state regulations in timber harvest that prohibit cutting contiguous parcels, and I don't know all the details, but there are regulations that would slow them down, so I don't know how long it would take a company to cut the remaining acres. So you have 350 employees presumably out of work if the mill doesn't sell. And the assumption is that one of these real estate investment trust companies would not keep the mill running. The mill is not particularly modern. I think it's in good shape. I don't mean to say that it's a disaster or anything, but I don't think it's been modernized, and timber gets hauled a long way to be milled. So let's assume the mill shuts down. Well, you know, there go a bunch of people, and there's no alternative employment for them around here. Our other leading industry in Western Klickitat County right now is in situ, which is, a defense industry company, but they're not going to absorb this number of people. And so there's a bunch of people, and there are a few people who actually live in SDS housing. So they stand not only to lose their jobs, but also their housing. I think SDS has some kinds of benefits, so people would lose health insurance and that kind of stuff. It's pretty grim for the employees and the contractors. And then SDS owns some commercial real estate. They own where our local supermarket is and the library. Now, those places have long-term leases, I understand, which would presumably be inherited by a new owner, but who knows? You know, this is the thing. We don't know what could happen. Just the fact, the environmental impact of a faster timber harvest is really devastating as well. They own significant parcels all along the White Salmon River. White salmon, if you don't know, is renowned for being cold and clear. And it's the fish going up the Columbia. Lots of them pop into the white salmon just to have a rest break on their way upriver. Wild fish are beginning to come in now that Conda Dam has been removed. We're one dam away from the Pacific. The prospects of significant populations of salmon in the white salmon are really important to salmon recovery. If the water quality begins to go, supposing cutting happens more rapidly, we're already threatened by increasing temperatures in the river. The public lands, which are strictly protected, of course, they have a high level of protection. The SDS lands act as corridors between the public lands and the river. Lots of them are contiguous to public lands. And so that's important for wildlife, for all kinds of wildlife. One of their parcels in lower white salmon has been uncut for so long that there's an unusual variety of mushroom in there. I mean, all sorts of things thrive on SDS land. And if the patterns change, water quality, wildlife corridors, and carbon sequestration, cutting the older trees seems like probably a pretty bad idea in terms of carbon sequestration and climate change. So the other thing, of course, is that if trees are cut and it's harvested and then it's converted to residential use, that is another order of bad news. The Trout Lake, where I am, is at the head of the river, and between us and the Columbia, there's an enormous water recharge through springs. Lower part of the river is really kept cold by the spring recharge that happens between us and the river. If houses start to be built and wells get drilled into that aquifer, that's really bad news for the river, really bad news.
Has SDS been open about these negotiations and the process of selling their company?
No, not at all. You talk to county commissioners and such, and even some of their employees, and they all go, well, it's a private company. They get to do what they want. We don't agree with that. And we have been trying to approach them to share at least minimal information, like, for example, when is the sale going to open? Who knows? What's the sale process? Again, who knows? Informally, we know that they selected a broker, which is kind of like standard for a timber sale. There's a bidding process, which I gather is pretty standard for timber sales of this size, but this is a significant sale. It's getting national attention, but the people who live here don't know anything about it. And the really, really unfortunate thing about this is people write to me all the time, well, let's get a conservation organization to buy it. Yeah, that takes 3 or 4 years. The other thing I would really like to engage with is employee ownership. I would really love to, and I think there's some interest amongst the employees, maybe not lots of them, but at least some. Again, that takes time, you know, and what we don't have is time. We feel that the community, all the communities, the natural community, the human community, have an interest. We're stakeholders here. I mean, we support them being a profit-making company, no problem. Friends of the White Salmon supports our resource industries here in this county, agriculture, cattle, timber, because on the whole, those industries are way less damaging to the environment than residential development. You know, once you pave something over, it's gone. And we appreciate that somebody can actually make money. It's not easy necessarily to make money in a resource industry. It's not easy to keep that business going. We appreciate their skill and all of that. But this is significantly different, where they're proposing to sell the whole company.
Jay McLaughlin is the executive director of Mount Adams Resource Stewards. They're a nonprofit that protects forest lands in the area and works closely with SDS.
We have a strong relationship and a very positive relationship with SDS Lumber. They are staffed by incredibly professional foresters and other professionals that are very good at what they do. And they have been good partners for us in terms of engagement in everything from federal forest collaborative groups that are planning projects on public lands to purchasing of logs that come from trees that we harvest off of our restoration projects and off of community forest lands that we own and manage, to even office space that we lease from them that supports our field crews.
How might the sale of SDS Lumber affect your work with the Mount Adams Resource Stewards?
Yeah, the sale potentially really calls into question the long-term prospects of maintaining working forest lands in this part of the South Mount Adams landscape and the Columbia River Gorge. And the prospect of new ownership and how they would manage those lands moving forward, especially if it were to be an ownership that then proceeded to look at selling some smaller parcels into non-forestry uses, such as development or something along those lines, would really challenge the kinds of things that we're hoping to be able to continue working on and addressing here in our work.
What are the best and worst case outcomes that are possible from this sale?
I think best case outcomes from this sale are that we, one, either have a company that's somewhat similar to SDS that really recognizes and continues forward this vertically integrated operation of forest lands and logging crews and milling infrastructure and barge lines, etc. You know, maybe the next best case scenario is at least a buyer or a new owner that is willing to work with partners that would include us and other organizations that have an interest in trying to figure out a way to acquire some of these lands to keep them in forestry and open space and continuing to benefit our communities. Worst case scenario is something that just moves too fast and is too driven by interests that might not give much attention or regard to local community values. And unfortunately, we've seen some of that around the country in terms of investment entities that really are on a pretty short time frame in terms of land acquisitions or timberland acquisitions and generating returns for their investors and then reselling the lands, often in a very fragmented fashion.
And there's also some threat that there might be development in areas that are sold by SDS.
Exactly. The threat that there could be conversion from forest lands to recreational properties, homes out in the forest, parcelized lands for development is very real. Right? It's a highly desirable place to live and to recreate. And especially over the past year, as a growing number of people realize that they can work remotely, realize that during the pandemic, we've seen real estate values skyrocket in this part of the state. There's clearly appeal for anybody owning lands, owning forest lands, when they're looking at or appraising the value of those lands. And if they're seeing that there's a higher value or a higher return for their company or for their investors than growing trees, there's that threat that they could opt for that kind of development or that kind of future sale. And that's what really concerns us. It's significant, whether it's from an environmental perspective, whether it's the kind of economy that has worked for these rural forest-based communities, whether it's from a wildfire perspective and the very real threat of continued construction of homes or structures out in what we call the wildland urban interface, and just what that poses as far as a threat to human life, what that represents as a cost to taxpayers who often have to hire the fire crews or pay the fire crews and fire suppression resources. And so all those things are potential negative outcomes associated with something that could dramatically change within this landscape if it isn't an ownership that continues the pretty amazing legacy that SDS Lumber has in this area.
That was Jay McLaughlin of Mount Adams Resource Stewards discussing the upcoming sale of Washington's SDS Lumber Company. Earlier in the story, I spoke with Pat Arnold from Friends of the White Salmon River. I also talked briefly with Jeff Weber, the president of SDS Lumber. He declined to interview before meeting with the other directors and coordinating their message. At that time, he said he was still unsure of the potential bidders and whether their company would be sold to one or several buyers. From KBOO News, I'm Ethan Sandweiss.
Hi, my name is Dr. Mark Allen Derry, and I'm an infectious diseases specialist in New Orleans.
Hi, my name is Doc Griggs, and I'm a community medicine doctor and health literacy expert. This is the Noise Filter Podcast, where an infectious diseases physician,
that's me, and a health literacy and communications expert,
that's me, talk about what you need to know about COVID-19. So let's get started.
So welcome to COVID Noise Filter. My name is Dr. Mark Alderi, and we are so happy to have guest co-hosting with us, Nurse Julia. Welcome to the show, Nurse Julia.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm so excited to be coming on board with you guys.
Thank you so much. And now on to the show.
Australian agricultural industry. Most of Australia's farm labor came from backpackers. Due to the pandemic, Australia has kept its borders closed, negatively affecting the number of laborers available, and it has affected their crop yield as well. The pandemic has exposed the stability of the labor and migration industry in Australia.
Though Australia has been able to weather the pandemic better with regards to caseload, they have faced a deficit of 30,000 farm workers. These backpackers were originally used as labor because few Australians were willing to pick crops. But now with heavier border control, they're not able to migrate. This led to tens of millions of crops that just went to waste.
As a result, there are more advocates now for an immigration overhaul and reforming the current policy. They want to create a pathway for agricultural workers to become permanent residents. Pre-pandemic, the government offered travelers visa extensions for agricultural work. They made up 80% of this workforce.
So with the introduction of the pandemic, the government tried offering subsidies to its unemployed citizens to work in these rural areas, but it failed. There was even a proposal to use prison labor, but that fell through due to opposition from farmers. As a result, the government flew workers from the Pacific Islands.
Australia needs a more stable workforce, which would help farmers as well. It would reduce the exploitative behavior and abuses that has been occurring. Some solutions to promote this would be through educating Australians about the industry and mandating a minimum wage to encourage more local workforce. This, in conjunction with immigration law, will take long, but can improve the industry.
Certainly. And when I thought they were talking about backpackers, I thought they were talking about literal backpackers. But now I realize.
Yeah. I did as well. I was trying to, you know,
right. That's on my what way I thought. Out, but I think that the word backpackers are being used in Australia are people who are migrating. Yeah. Seasonally to help, but I was thinking like
seriously. I mean, I'm curious, you know, the amount of money that went into flying people in to help, you know.
Oh yeah, I'm sure.
Sure that was massive, unfortunately.
Global attacks on healthcare workers. Fear and mistrust can cause people to commit unspeakable acts. Terrifyingly, the coronavirus pandemic has only amplified those feelings and the healthcare workers charged with taking care of us as the targets.
Now, we've discussed that healthcare workers and health department officials in the United States are being treated so badly that they're leaving the field in droves, but this has been a global problem. According to ABC News, two Nigerian nurses were attacked by the family of a deceased COVID-19 patient. One nurse had her hair ripped out and suffered a fracture, while the second nurse was beaten into a coma. A woman in Mexico, who had worked as a nurse for 40 years without incident, was walking home from a shift at the hospital and got hot coffee thrown on her by someone as they yelled, "Infected." Also in the Netherlands, rioters burned down a coronavirus testing center.
My goodness. Researchers from the Geneva-based Insecurity Insight and the University of California Berkeley's Human Rights Center found that of the 1,100 and more threats or acts of violence against healthcare workers and facilities last year, about 400 of those attacks were related to COVID-19, and many of them motivated by fear or frustration. Following the attacks in Nigeria, nurses stopped treating patients and demanded that the hospitals improve their security. Almost 2 weeks went by before the nurses went back to work, but now with armed guards.
Experts say that even though health workers may be targets of attack, the community suffers when they lose access to medical care after a clinic or medical facility is forced to close due to threats or violence to the workers.
Nurse Julia, I'm fascinated by how these amazing nurses in Nigeria, they went on strike. They didn't work for 2 weeks unless they had armed guards. I just was wondering what your thoughts were on that.
To be honest, I don't blame them. I think a lot of times people don't realize the danger, you know, when you're working in public service that you can run into. And, you know, it's been one of those things where lots of times, unfortunately, while doing your job in the healthcare industry, you do come across patients who may be combative or upset about family members and things like that. And while your heart breaks for their loved one, them acting out irrationally just isn't something that can be tolerated. So, you know, you'd be surprised at how many nurses have been victims of abuse in the healthcare setting by family members and patients. So this is interesting, but I'm so glad that they were able to get them some security so that they could get back to work, fortunately.
Absolutely. What folklore can teach us about public health. All right, well, this is going to be good. COVID-19 will obviously be a major historical event, but what stories are people telling about the pandemic now that will prevail and stick around for decades to come? According to Slate, these legends and stories speak to a longer history of medical folklore, and much of the rhetoric actually repeats itself.
Yeah, according to folklorist Andrea Kitta, one prevailing aspect of medical folklore is a distrust in structural medicine. People often circulate stories about household remedies for COVID, which are empowering to the public but often minimally effective. These kinds of stories echo old-fashioned tales about garlic or lemon water.
Now, vaccine refusal and skepticism does have a long history. And in the past, people were wary of vaccines because they included animal parts in production. Even though these methods are no longer used, the advent of mRNA vaccines have inspired similar anxieties. And according to Kita, we tend to view our bodies as pure with our skin as a barrier. Vaccines cross that barrier, which is understandably nerve-wracking.
Individual patient narratives will also live on as cautionary tales. Instances of long-hauler COVID patients and healthcare workers giving the virus to family members have familiar and resonant consequences, and their memory will likely live on through storytelling.
Yes, indeed. An understanding of what stories resonate and prevail could also be essential to public health now and again in the future. The history of medical folklore does show us that people are affected by anecdotes and emotionally effective stories, and this should affect public health messaging. And I know, Nurse Julian, another story you and I read, something about public health messaging, and maybe when what we had talked about was that perhaps we will see that in nursing school and medical school, we'll see classes that are now going to be dedicated to teaching best practices for talking to the public. And maybe it is through folklore and stories. What are your thoughts on that?
Absolutely. I couldn't agree more. I think storytelling and, you know, people's experiences do have a way of moving the crowd, so to speak. And I wouldn't be surprised if I saw that included in best practices for messaging and reaching the masses. It'll be interesting to see which route they go. But indeed, as you have mentioned, we definitely need to see best practices incorporated into academia. So that'll be interesting. The failings of public health messaging.
Oh boy, this is one that we definitely need to hear about. So can't wait.
The pandemic has thrust the field of public health into the limelight as governmental health organizations try to enact guidelines to contain COVID. According to The Atlantic, however, there have been some major failings of public health messaging throughout the pandemic.
Oh boy, has there been. In fact, one of the most significant issues in the pandemic response is a lack of trust in the public from experts. Initially, at the beginning of the pandemic, some experts were concerned that safety measures like masks and rapid tests would lure the public into a false sense of security, causing them to take risks that would undermine those precautions. However, much of the data communicates that this would not have been the case. In fact, according to the National Academy of Sciences, wearing masks tends to demonstrate adherence to other safety measures as well. And there was a study out of Germany that actually showed that very elegantly as well. So it's nice to see that the NAS, National Academy of Sciences, also showed that.
Lots of the messaging to the public was focused on providing behavioral guidelines, which may not have been as effective or empowering as education. If the CDC and WHO had supplied more resources to fully explain the nature of transmission, the public might have had a less fixed impression of the virus and adapted more easily to changing guidelines.
Among experts and the public, there has been a culture of shaming those who are perceived as reckless. Ugh. Now, this behavior is ineffective for preventing unsafe actions. I would agree with that, and makes it seem as though more people are resistant to precautions like mask mandates. This has also reinforced absolutism in safety measures as opposed to focusing on harm reduction, which is more effective and palatable for the public.
According to The Atlantic, pandemic response failed to balance certainty and action. There was overemphasis on waiting to act until evidence was certain for many efforts to reduce airborne transmission, while the public raced to reduce surface transmission, which there was little evidence to support.
Yeah, you know, I 100% agree. I think that one of the things that we learned from the pandemic more than anything else, Nurse Julia, and I would love to hear your response on this, is that what we don't learn in medical school or nursing school or what have you is how to effectively communicate to the public. And I think moving forward, that really should be criteria in medical school, in nursing school, in all health allied health schools should also have courses on how to effectively communicate to the public and understand what basic communication skills are in the event that we are asked to speak directly to the public. At least there will be something for us to fall back on. What are your thoughts on that?
Actually, I couldn't agree more. I think in school, lots of the efforts are geared towards teaching. You know, so many of my colleagues have made the comment that, you know, we learned about the pandemic in school. Never did we ever think that we would see one. And I think there is a notion that, hey, we're going to learn about these things with the hope that science and medicine will carry us through and it won't be something that we'll actually experience. So to your point, there's not really been a lot of prepping of being, you know, able to communicate in the event that that doesn't happen. And as someone who's kind of in the media space, it's just very interesting to see, because lots of doctors have kind of been thrown into that into that light to try and debunk misinformation. So it's just very interesting to see how it all has played out. But going forward, yes, I think not only for healthcare professionals, but also, you know, leaders in the community, there should be some coursework there to be completed as well.
Yeah, I 100% agree. And I hope that we will see a field of study emanate from the public health world or the scientific world or what have you, that specifically will show physicians or nurses or healthcare workers who are tasked to communicate with the public what the best practices are. So, you know, as somebody like yourself, Nurse Julia, myself, who are in the media and who are tasked with speaking to the public, I often found myself, well, just telling just the science, like you were implying a moment ago, the science will speak for itself. And stunningly, what we found is that it actually didn't. And so there has to be best practices right. for us to lean on. And I think this will be an evolving story.
Thanks for listening to the Noise Filter Daily Podcast. Remember, get checked, get fit, get moving. And remember to get some rest to boost your immune system. And Doc,
protect yourself and others by staying home, and please wear masks when you go outside. Remember, health is a human right.
This is Ursula K. Le Guin, and you are listening to KBOO, the cheerful voice of social conscience. KBOO, Portland.
For nearly two decades, communities across the Pacific Northwest have been fighting off multiple efforts to turn the region